Well, from that hymn that is based on this incredibly significant passage, we turn to that passage now. Now, in fact, this incident is recorded in Matthew's Gospel, in Mark's Gospel, and also in Luke's Gospel. Just try and imagine this. The disciples have been following Jesus now for quite some time. They've responded to his call, and they've listened to his teachings. They've watched his actions. They've been stunned by many of his miracles. And Jesus now, in a very strategic place in the land, as we will see, draws those disciples aside, and he asks them two questions. First of all, who do all the people think I am now? And he gets very interesting answers, as we will see. And then he turns to the 12 with that question that is as personal for you and for me this morning as it was all those years ago. Tell me then, he says, who do you say that I am? You know, I've been retired for almost a year and a half. I can't believe it. And that really makes me sit up when I realize that is almost half the total time that Jesus spent ministering in this world. Do you reckon he only ministered for about 3 years? 3 years to turn the world upside down. And now at this stage in his ministry, he knows the last journey is approaching. There's a very graphic verse somewhere in the Bible that says, he set his face steadfastly towards Jerusalem. That's the point Jesus is at now. He knows that last awful week is about to come. And he knows before he dies and before he's risen again, he has to make sure with his disciples that the future of the Christian faith in history is going to be secure. So he takes them to this place. I don't know if any of you have ever been. We only managed it, I think, once in the five times that I've had the privilege of visiting the land of Israel. But it's a very, very beautiful place. Sadly, it was a bit spoiled the day we were there, because there was a group of Jewish youngsters, I suppose, typical teenagers, with a very loud transistor radio that spoiled the peace of the place, because the River Jordan is there and it flows through lovely woods and trees and all the rest of it. That is modern Caesarea Philippi, or its other name is Banias, and there is a reason for that, as we will see. Now, this was the area Jesus asked these questions. And it is not without significance when we actually examine this geographical location, about 20-odd miles north of the Sea of Galilee. This area was a religious stronghold in history. Four things about it. Number one, it had been one of the centers of Syrian Baal or Baal worship. Now, some of you will remember Baal from the Old Testament and the battle that the prophet Elijah had trying to win back the Israelites who were tottering away from their faith in the God of Israel and who were starting to worship the god Baal. And you remember Elijah had that contest by fire on the top of Mount Carmel. So this area had been a stronghold of Baal worship. Secondly, there was a cave in this area, and it was reputed to be the birthplace of the great god Pan, the Greek god of nature. And that place today is sometimes called Panias or Banias. And it goes all the way back to this legend that the god Pan of the Pan Pipes, was born in that cave. So there's a second religious heritage. Thirdly, it is up in that area that the River Jordan begins, and begins its journey all the way down through the land, bringing to mind the awesomeness of the history of Judaism. So Judaic history comes into the picture. And then last, but by no means least, this place in Jesus' day was known as Caesarea Philippi. Because believe it or not, in that very area, a great white marble temple had been erected to the godhead of the Roman Emperor Caesar. Now, if you put all that together, it was a center of Baal worship. It was rooted in Pan worship. A lot of Jewish history was associated with the area. And in Jesus' own era, a very temple had been erected there that said, Caesar is divine. Caesar is God. Let me quote this wonderful quote from good old Willie Barclay. Here indeed is a dramatic picture. Here is a homeless, penniless Galilean carpenter with 12 very ordinary men around him. At the moment, the Orthodox Jews are actually plotting and planning to destroy him as a dangerous heretic. He stands in this area, littered with the temples of the Syrian gods, in a place where the ancient Greek gods looked down, in a place where the history of Israel itself crowded in upon the minds of men, where the white marble splendor of the home of Caesar worship dominated the landscape and compelled the eye. And there, of all places Jesus could have chosen in the land, this amazing carpenter stands and asks his disciples who they believe him to be and expects the answer, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Son of the Living God. It's as if Jesus here deliberately sets himself against the background of the world's religions in all their history and splendor and demanded to be compared with them and to have the verdict given in his favor. You could bring this bang up to date in this era of multi-faith and multi-religion and all the rest of it. You could say that even this morning, Jesus stands against all the religions of the world and asks of us this question, who do you say that I am? Now, Jesus goes about the question, the final, ultimate, personal question that is as relevant for you this morning and for me as it was to those disciples in Caesarea Philippi all these years ago. He goes about it in an interesting way. He doesn't go straight to the disciples with a question. First of all, he asks a preliminary question. His question is, tell me, my disciples, who do the people out there think I am? Now, the people had been following Jesus for months. They'd been with him on the shores of Galilee. They'd sat and listened to his amazing teaching. They'd seen his miracles. Some of them had been personally fed at the shore. Some of them had been healed. And inevitably, Jesus must have known, there must have been curiosity in the minds of the ordinary people. So he says to the disciples, who do they think I am? And we get three answers. The disciples give three different answers. And they're all wonderful answers. They're brilliant answers. But they're not the final answer. Let's look at the answers. Some of the people, says the disciples, think you are John the Baptist, come back to life again. Now, my favourite character in the New Testament is John the Baptist. I once wrote an essay on him when I was studying for divinity at New College many, many moons ago. And I just love the bravery and the boldness. And he just didn't have any fear, did John the Baptist. He didn't care what folk thought of him, how he looked, what he ate. He obeyed God and he went out and he was the forerunner. He knew somebody bigger was coming, but he knew he was strategic and he preached the message that had the folk coming in droves. And John was an amazing character. And it's a high honour that some of the ordinary people thought Jesus was John the Baptist, come back to life again. Some of them thought Jesus was Elijah. Now, my favourite character in the Old Testament is Elijah. And if you ask anybody in Strathbrook, they will remember a series of sermons in Elijah that seemed to go on for years. Because I loved that man so much. And we ever wondered if we were going to get to Mount Carmel when the fire would come down. But Elijah was the forerunner. He was a very, very similar character to John the Baptist. Remember, he was fed by ravens. Remember, he made a miracle with a few drops of oil and a few grains of wheat in a widow's house. First of all, greedily asking for it for himself first. But then he fed that widow. In the Old Testament, of all places, Elijah raised a boy back to life again. And then he fought that great climatic battle against the prophets of Baal and Mount Carmel. So no greater honour, you would think, could the ordinary people have paid Jesus by saying, he's Elijah, come again. And then some of them thought he was Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah, I think, was regarded to be one of the bravest of the prophets because he was very much persecuted. And I don't know if you remember what Jeremiah thought of it when God asked him in the first place to be a prophet. Jeremiah said, "Know me, God. Know me. Find somebody else." And do you remember Jeremiah's excuse? "I'm far too young, God. I'm just a child. You need to get a mature person." And God says, "No, it's you I'm calling. And I tell you, Jeremiah, you will go out there and the word you speak will be like a fire. And it will be like a hammer that breaks the rock in pieces." Now, it's wonderful. These are who Jesus was compared with by the ordinary people. And a higher comparison you couldn't find than John the Baptist, Elijah, or Jeremiah. Three powerful human beings living a life about as near to God as you could get. Good answers, great answers, but Jesus isn't satisfied. And so he comes back to the group now. That's who they think. Who do you think that I am? And it is to Peter's credit. Because as you know, Peter quite often put his two big feet in it with Jesus. He was that sort of impulsive character. "I'll never deny you, Jesus." And three times that night he does. And more than once we see Peter the impulsive getting it wrong. But not on this occasion. Peter is bang on right. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now, it's interesting if you compare the three Gospels. Here in Matthew, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Mark is very brief. "You are the Christ." Luke, "You are the Christ of God." The word Christ is the same as the word Messiah, or the word anointed one. And here Jesus knows at last, the message has got through. My disciple knows the ultimate truth. I'm not a man only. I'm not even a superman only. I am the Christ. I am the Messiah. I am the Son of the living God. Two things as we close this morning. Essentially, Peter's discovery is that human categories, even the highest of human categories, like John or Elijah or Jeremiah, however high they might be, are not high enough to fully describe who Jesus Christ is. Napoleon, that famous man from France, once said this. Napoleon didn't get a lot of things right in his life, didn't he? Not, but he got this one right. He said, "I know men," he said, "and Jesus Christ is more than a man." That was the word of Napoleon. So that's the first thing. No human categories are high enough to describe Christ. But secondly, and this is how this question is as relevant this morning, and it is a challenge to the Philip Pullmans and the Richard Dawkinses and all the others that are proliferating our society today. Who do we in this church this morning believe in our hearts and confess with our lips that Jesus Christ is? Your mother cannot make this answer for you. Your son or your daughter cannot make this answer for you. Your minister cannot make this answer for you. Your church elder cannot make this answer for you. You've got to make it from your own heart. Now, there are some folk, when they are faced with the challenge of answering this question, who do not want to know. The Philip Pullmans of this world, up until now, but God's grace is without limit, don't want to know. The Richard Dawkins of this world very aggressively do not want to know. These people are described in the Old Testament in the book of Zechariah, chapter 7, verse 11, like this. These people refused to listen, and they pulled away their shoulders, and they stopped their ears, lest they should hear. This people's heart has become hard. Their ears have become dull of hearing. Their eyes have been closed, lest at any time they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and should understand with their heart and should be converted and I should heal them. Tragically, when folk are challenged with this question. Do you remember Felix the governor? That's an awesomely tragic figure in the Acts of the Apostles. When he'd summoned the Apostle Paul in to preach to him, and Paul preached with such power, we're told that Felix was like this, under the conviction of the preaching of the Apostle Paul. But when Paul challenges Felix, "Right, Felix, what do you want to do about it? Will you believe today?" Do you remember Felix's answer? "Not today, Paul. When I find a more convenient time, I'll send for you again." And the tragedy is there's no record he ever found that time. If God is asking you, if God is knocking at the door of your heart this morning, saying, "Let me in, receive Christ, and you will know in your heart that he is the Son of God and your Savior," don't put off to tomorrow what you must do today. Nathanael confessed, "Christ, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." The woman of Samaria, that wonderful woman at the well, an outcast that Jesus caused scandal by speaking to. A, because she was a woman. B, she was a Samaritan. And C, she had gone through five husbands and was currently living with one who wasn't her husband. Very modern 21st century woman. She was. But she got converted. She got the living water. And she rushed home to her village and said, "You must come with me. And I will show you a man who told me my life story. Is not this the Christ?" And she knew in her heart. Martha, that wonderful woman that is so denigrated sometimes. I remember being hauled over the coals once in Strathbrook Church because I preached a sermon about Martha and Mary, and somebody did not like what I said about Martha. But Martha did get it wrong that day, folks. She should have sat at the feet of Jesus. She shouldn't have been rushing about getting the kettle on, however good her intentions were. But her heart was in the right place, and she was wonderful. And it is to Martha that Jesus gave that immortal word, "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live." And Martha confesses, "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who should come into the world." Or how about Thomas? Thomas has become infamous. A wee bit like Martha getting the tea on rather than listening at Jesus' feet. And Thomas has become infamous because of his doubts when he said, "I won't believe until I see and touch." But when Jesus appeared, he just falls on his knees with a confession, "My Lord and my God." And one of my favorites, the man from Ethiopia, probably the first convert from the continent of Africa. And just see how the church is growing enormously in the continent of Africa right now. Remember that Ethiopian? He was a follower of the Jewish faith, and he'd been up to Jerusalem for the Jewish services and ceremonies. He's on his way back, stopped for a tea break, and he's in his chariot reading his Bible, and we're actually told the passage he was reading. It was Isaiah chapter 53. It says, "He was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities." And along comes Philip the deacon. And Philip gets up into the chariot and says to the man from Africa, "Do you understand what you're reading?" And the man from Africa says, "I'm sorry, I can't understand it unless somebody shows me what it means." And Philip preaches out of the Old Testament prophecy the message of the gospel, and the end result is that man from Africa is converted to Christ in the chariot and asks to be baptized. And Philip says, "If you believe with all your heart, you may." And the man from Africa says, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." So who is he to you this morning? The scoundrel Christ, a fictitious divinity made up by the Apostle Paul? Or can you do what the letter of John says we need to do? Whoever will confess that Jesus is the Son of God, God dwells in that person, and that person dwells in God. May his grace open our hearts to say, "I believe, and I know whom I believe this morning," for his sake. Amen.